Don't expect much from the Derb this week, listeners. I'm so depressed I can hardly move. Aren't you? You know what week this was. But I'm going to remind you anyway. This was the week when the prospect of an Obama presidency stared us in the face. I'll admit it, I'm in despair. With our national economy swirling away down the toilet bowl, we can take some small comfort in the fact that Obama won't be able to do as much harm as he might do if he had big revenues coming in to the federal government for him to squander on pointless and destructive socialist extravaganzas. But you can be sure he'll do as much harm as he can. He will fill up his administration with people like himself, charmed life meritocrats whose pampered heads are filled up with all the poisonous pap of 1980s college radicalism, the stuff Roger Kimball exposed so brilliantly in his book Tenured Radicals, which is now, by the way, just out in a new and expanded edition. Australians have an expression I like. They talk about the cultural cringe. That's the posture adopted by a person like Obama when confronting foreigners, most especially foreigners who have some historical grudge against the USA. Obama will make world cringing tours. He will cringe to the Middle Eastern despots. He will cringe to the Africans. He will cringe to the Chinese and the Russians. He will cringe to the mafiosi rulers of Latin America. This coming Obama presidency will be a cringe-a-thon. And you can forget about any kind of sane immigration policy. George W. Bush's policies have been lampooned as, quote, invade the world, invite the world. Well, we won't be invading anybody in an Obama presidency, except possibly some place where we can be totally and absolutely sure that our national interest is not involved, so that the world can gasp in admiration at our idealistic selflessness. We will sure be inviting, though. A nation like the USA, which, as Obama will be glad to tell you, has a blood-stained criminal record stretching back through history, a nation like that has to make amends somehow for its appalling crimes. What better way than to open up the border? Come one, come all. I can tell you one legacy of the Obama years right away, even before they start. My grandchildren will live in a United States with a population of 1 billion. Most of whom will be nursing some historical grievance against America. What a fun, harmonious nation that will be, won't it? What else was this week? Well, it was the week we got exposed to the true, clueless awfulness of John McCain. Did you stay awake through that whole wretched debate? No, me neither. I did catch McCain's glowing references to his good friend Russ Feingold, his dear friend Joe Lieberman, and his very dear friend Ted Kennedy. Doesn't this guy have any Republican friends? What's he even doing in the Republican Party? Why doesn't he just team up with his good friend Barack Obama to usher in the glorious new age of social justice and redemption? McCain could stay home running the welcome wagon for illegal immigrants, while Obama goes off cringing round the world. Hey, that'd work. Oh, yes, look, I know. John McCain honestly loves his country, and he's served it with great and honourable distinction as a warrior. Dorothy Rabinowitz got this right in her Wall Street Journal column on Thursday. The choice here, she said, is between a man who has a bone deep, instinctive love for his country, and a man who doesn't. Well, that's true, and that's to John McCain's great credit. From the point of view of a conservative, though, what else is to his credit? anything to lift up a Conservative's spirits at the thought of a McCain administration? I can't think of a darn thing. How did we end up with this guy on the GOP ticket? I watched Mitt Romney on the telly the other night, talking calm good sense about the financial crisis. I can't say I ever cared for Romney. I was a Ron Paul voter. Listening to Romney, though, I'd have to say, it seems like some kind of cosmic tragedy that we ended up with McCain instead of him. Is God punishing us somehow? Perhaps for all those historical crimes the Obamas can't wait to tell you about? Well, if he is, 4 years of President Obama crawling around the world bleating out apologies while wearing a big kick me sign across his rear end should at least put everything right with the Supreme Being. And what else was this week? Well, it was the week of the sucker. Sucker number one, the fool who calculated carefully before taking out a loan, figuring out how much he could sensibly borrow, based on his ability to service the loan. What a sucker! In case the poor sap didn't know how dumb he was, John McCain drove the point home by kneeing him forcefully in the groin at Tuesday's debate. "The other guy," said John as he put the knee in, "the guy who had borrowed far above his ability to service the loan, that guy would receive the tender ministrations of the federal government under a McCain administration. The government would buy his mortgage, scrub a couple of zeros off the loan amount, and then sell it back to him for a nominal fee. The first guy, the sucker who'd behaved responsibly, would have his taxes jacked up to finance the government's loving favours to the second guy. See how it works? You play by the rules, you live responsibly, and you get the old groin cruncher from John. Act like a drunken sailor on shore leave, and the federal government will shine the glory of its countenance upon you and shower down its bounty. And here comes sucker number two. The guy who, lacking any great athletic or dramatic gifts or any keen entrepreneurial skills, went for a middle-class job in the private sector with one of those 401k plans that the human resources lady assured him would see him safely through a long retirement. Well, guess what, sucker? It was all a con. Your carefully saved retirement funds went to buy an estate in Hawaii for some investment bank CEO and to buy a fleet of limos for some billionaire in the Chinese government. Now you'll have to work till you drop. Sorry about that. You just made a bad life choice there. You remember that old uncle who used to collar you at family functions and hiss into your ear with a blast of bourbon and cigarette fumes? Get a government job, son. Well, you should have listened to him. Government people didn't get suckered into the 401k scam. They made sure they got defined benefit pension plans with inflation escalator clauses and built-in Medicare supplements. While you work till you drop, they're heading for the golf course. If you're nice to them, the public sector retirees might let you caddy for them a couple of rounds. The tips aren't bad. You could do worse. Face it, this is no country for old men who put their faith in the human resources lady. Listener, I have two teenage kids. Neither of them shows any sign of entrepreneurial zest. Neither of them is going to light up the silver screen or the basketball court. So I intend to do my damnedest to make sure they both get government jobs, preferably in the imperial capital down there on the Potomac, where all the money and power concentrates. I don't know about no country for old men, but this is surely no country for private sector employees. And just going back to that stupid debate for a moment, Why was it so boring? For all their faults, neither John McCain nor Barack Obama is an intrinsically boring person. So why was this such an excruciating snoozer? Well, one reason, it seems to me, was the narrowness of the topics. One thing that I've watched, unhappily, over my lifetime, which hasn't been that long, has been the narrowing of public discourse. There are whole huge areas you just can't talk about without being tagged as a bad, mean, cruel-hearted person. Take homosexuality, for instance. In the Palin-Biden debate, when the topic of full marriage-style rights for homosexuals came up, Sarah Palin fell over herself to show her approval. And this is the conservative side of the GOP ticket. Heaven only knows how John McCain would have responded. Compulsory same-sex dating services in all federal institutions, probably. Sarah is a married lady with kids from out in Red State America, fundamentalist Christian. And yet, oh boy, she gets breathless just telling you how keen she is on gay rights. What about those of us who aren't keen on them? Who don't want their boys taken off on camping trips by homosexual scoutmasters, or seduced by homosexual college residence advisers, who think that homosexuals should keep quiet about their preferences and leave the rest of us and our institutions alone. Don't we get to say anything? Isn't any other opinion allowed other than wholehearted approval? No, it isn't. And no, we don't get to say anything. Because we are bad, mean people. End of discussion. Another example. When I give political talks, I sometimes, just for the little frisson of malicious pleasure I get, I sometimes say the phrase, population policy. People gasp when I say that. Population policy? It brings to people's minds, you know, ethnic cleansing, forced sterilization, concentration camps, the euthanizing of disabled people, and all the rest of it. And yet, every country, including this one, has a population policy. It's not a question of having one or not having one. It's a question of having a good one or having a bad one. Not having a population policy, not even being able to talk about population policy, is itself a population policy. It has consequences for your population. Different consequences than you'd have with some other approach. It's a policy. No policy is a policy. The Census Bureau recently told us that the USA will have 440 million people in 2050, when my kids are middle-aged. That is the result of current population policy. Is everybody happy with that or not? Who knows? We're not allowed to talk about it. In 1950, the US population was 150 million. People tell me that the USA was a pretty nice place in 1950. When I came here first in the early 1970s, the population was 200 million and change. It was a great place to live. Will it still be a great place to live with 440 million? What do you think? Well, whatever you think, you'd best keep it to yourself. This is something we're not allowed to talk about. Unless, of course, you wholeheartedly approve of current population policy. Which, by the way, does not exist, because there is no such thing as population policy. That narrowing of the zone of permitted public discourse, that is why there have been no questions about immigration in any of the debates. For all the populist pretense and the phony town hall formats and the bogus informality, these debates are high elite events run on high elite rules. And our high elites, the media and political and academic panjandrums who decide these things, they don't want us talking about immigration. They especially don't want us talking about it with a black candidate in the race. Immigration is a topic faintly tinged with race, because most immigrants come from the Third World. Now, to talk about race, even in the most indirect and peripheral way, is unacceptably low class, like chewing tobacco or having linoleum on your floors. It can't be done. This provides Barack Obama with a protective shield. It means that there are whole swathes of public policy that can't be talked about in his presence. Immigration, crime, subprime mortgages, education, all out of bounds. That's why these debates are so dull and so full of who-cares nitpicking wonkery about petty tax breaks and wind farms and foreign aid, stuff that either nobody believes or that nobody cares about. Does anybody in the United States really believe that either of these guys will cut taxes on the middle class? Or find Osama bin Laden? Or make health care or college more affordable? Or eliminate our dependence on Middle East oil? Or stop Iran from getting nukes? Or eliminate government programs that don't work? That one, by the way, was a thing that both candidates promised to do in this week's debate. They were both lying through their teeth, of course. Does anybody believe any of these things will be done by either candidate? Anybody? I thought not. If you don't believe that the race taboo is a protective shield for the Democratic candidate, just listen to how his supporters pump up every innocuous remark by the McCain people into a racist outrage. Item. Sarah Palin said the following thing at a fundraiser in Colorado. Quote, "Our opponent is someone who sees America as being so imperfect, imperfect enough that he's palling around with terrorists who would target their own country. This is not a man who sees America like you and I see America." End quote. Okay, here comes Representative Gregory Meeks, a Democrat from New York. Quote from Mr. Meeks, commenting on Sarah's remark. Quote, "He's not one of us. That's racial. That's fear. They know they can't win on the issues, so the last resort they have is race and fear." End quote. Item. Representative Yvette Clark, also a Democrat, and also from New York. I'm taking these from the New York Observer, so these idiots are all from New York. I'm sure the same things are being said elsewhere. Representative Clark found a racial subtext in Sarah's repeated appeals to Joe Sixpack and hockey moms. Quote from Representative Clark, quote, "Who exactly is Joe Sixpack, and who are these hockey moms? Is that supposed to be terminology that is of common ground to all Americans? I don't find that. It leaves a lot of people out." End quote. Item. Here's New York State Senator Bill Perkins, quote, "They are obviously playing on people's fears and prejudices in a desperate way. While not explicitly relating to race, they are clearly creating the opportunity for those inclined to come to those conclusions. I think it is going to become more explicit as we move forward. It's subtle now, but not so subtle as to be mistaken." End quote. Item. Kevin Parker, another New York State senator, said, quote, "If you have to remind people that Barack Obama is African American, you have reached the bottom." End quote. The fundamental message here is that if you don't support Barack Obama, you are a racist. And that shuts people up, which of course is what it's intended to do. If you were listening very carefully this week, behind all the shrieks and wails coming from citizens scrutinising their 401k plans, and the gentle sobbing from the direction of Wall Street, and the dull, soporific drone of politicians pretending to debate each other, in front of moderators pretending that they're impartial, you might have heard a faint croaking sound in the background. That, ladies and gentlemen, was the final death rattle of conservatism in America. Yep, it's over. 2008 is to the conservatism of Bill Buckley and Ronald Reagan as 1930 was to the conservatism of Bill McKinley, Irving Babbitt and Calvin Coolidge. We're looking at a quarter century of increasing federal power, with nobody of any importance daring to resist. In the fullness of time, round about 2033, a new Bill Buckley will come up, and there will be a rebirth of conservatism in the United States. If there still is a United States, which there are strong grounds to doubt. I sometimes quietly wonder to myself in the long, dark watches of the night if Bill foresaw this. His passing, at any rate, was timely. He died in February. His movement croaked out its last breath in October. It has, of course, been moribund for some time, and I do think that Bill knew that. Apart from some vaguely patriotic platitudes from all the candidates, can you recall any conservative sentiments being uttered in this long presidential campaign, other than from Ron Paul and Duncan Hunter? No, neither can I. You won't be hearing any either. Fiscal restraint? You must be kidding. Protection of our sovereignty? In your dreams. English only as the language of our federal government? Yeah, keep dreaming. Eliminate the Department of Education? For goodness sake. Abolish race preferences? Oh yeah, right. Free market in health care? Never happen. Privatize Social Security? Sorry, pal. Conservatism is dead. Dead as mutton. Forget about it. It would be convenient to blame George W. Bush for killing off American conservatism, but it's nothing so neat. Bush, of course, is not a conservative, just a muddle-headed centrist with a nice line in Evangelical Patter. Jeff Hart explained all that to us years ago, and Bruce Bartlett wrote a fine book about it the year before last. There are greater forces at work here than just our president's blunderings, though. Big, slow historical tides, surging and pulling. I read David Frum's 1994 book, Dead Right, when it came out, and I thought it was brilliant. I still quote from it. This year, David brought out a new book with the title Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. All filled with wretched little penny-ante stuff about pollution taxes and campaigns against obesity and goodness knows what else. The book's on my shelf here. I never finished it. What would be the point? Hey, look, I told you I was depressed. There's always some good news, though, if you go looking for it. Perhaps not enough to lift the gloom, but enough to raise a brief, wan smile, at least. This week's good news was the conviction of O.J. Simpson on 12 counts of armed robbery and kidnapping in Las Vegas. In a creepy coincidence that everyone noticed, the conviction came 13 years to the day since Simpson's acquittal for the murder of his wife and her friend. A double murder for which Simpson's guilt is, as they say in Ireland, known even to the dogs in the street. Sentencing on this last conviction isn't till December 5th, but it looks as though Simpson can't possibly get less than 15 years. He's 61 years old, so jail is likely going to take up the rest of his life. Any chance they could manage to lose the key? Let's hope so. A weird little sidebar to this financial crisis story has been the financial collapse of Iceland. Yes, Iceland, up there in the far North Atlantic. Hang a left at Greenland. Iceland's population is 320,000. That's about a quarter of the population of my little outer suburban county. Iceland is one of those places you never hear about, where nothing happens. And on the rare occasions that you do think about the place, you guess that they probably have a pretty good thing going there. Like New Zealand or Slovenia or Luxembourg. Per capita GDP is fourth highest in the world, $64,000. The USA is 12th in that league, with $46,000. Iceland also has a very low Gini coefficient. That's the standard measure of income inequality. Iceland's Gini is 0.25, the fourth lowest in the world. Well, there they were in Reykjavik and Hafnarfjörður, floating along smugly in their inconspicuous prosperity and equality, when suddenly their house fell down. It turns out the Icelandic banks were all grossly over-leveraged, to the tune of about 20 times Iceland's gross national product, so that as credit dried up, they couldn't service their obligations. Now the poor old Icelanders are running around nationalising everything, very much like the Bush administration. You know what, though? 10 years from now, I bet the Icelanders will be as comfortable, as quietly rich, and as smug as ever. Places like that always land on their feet. And if not, heck, the entire population could come and migrate here to Suffolk County. We'd hardly notice them. That's your Radio Derb for this sad week, ladies and gentlemen, as the last flickering twilight of conservatism fades into the dark night of community organizer socialism. Get a copy of Roger Kimball's book, Tenured Radicals, to find out what's in our next president's head. This time next year I shall probably be in a re-education camp, so make the best of Radio Derb while we last. This is your sad host, John Derbyshire, signing off despondently for Radio Derb.